Good evening, James McKenney with my Science Hour. It is July 30th, 2015. Just a little recap, if you weren't aware, I think mostly everybody is, last week, July 23rd, 20th anniversary of the discovery, the official discovery of the comet Hale-Bopp. I did a special. And briefly, there was so much material to cover, there were 3 extra hours of lecture. And so that I actually put up for sale because really it was a lot of work, which involved a bit of kind of dangerous travel, let's put it that way. So for that reason, trying to just recoup some of the money that I put into this. But it was a very important, something that I had been waiting to do probably really for over 20 years. And confirmed, as I said last week, that Hale-Bopp was what Harrington was looking at. What Harrington went to New Zealand. And also confirmed that this concept of 3,600-year orbit, which everybody except me is repeating out there about Planet X, that is totally incorrect, false, never was true. I never did believe that, but now I've confirmed that. And it really started with Sitchin, who talked to Harrington back in the mid-80s, when Harrington really didn't have a sound idea of what was going on with the Planet X issue. He had been bird-dogging it for a while. But anyway, that 3,600-year orbit, baloney, complete baloney. That's all it is, all it ever was. And I've been saying that all along. It's just that now I have the proof. So at any rate, the true history of Hale-Bopp, the whole issue of Planet X, and a lot of history really got put together with the discoveries that I've made. So if you want to know more, listen to my show last week and then the 3 additional hours of lecture are for sale, $24.95. And we're looking in. There's like some people who actually paid $39.95. I raised it up to $40, $39.95, which I said I would do during the pre-sale. But then after looking at it, I thought, you know, I got to keep these prices somewhat down for the people out there. People just are hurting, and, you know, I want to keep this. I still have to recuperate some money from my own investment in, like I say, the travel, equipment, and everything else I did to discover this information. But still, $24.95 for that 3 extra hours plus supporting material is really, in my case, worth it, because it's the only real information out there now dealing with the topic of Planet X. Also, you can get it free if you purchase $250 or more, any combination of items on my webpage. And remember that also 50% of the profit from any of the sales that are going on now go to the Wing Generator Project. So it's a way to get your Hale-Bopp Planet X special download free. And this is a download. It's not a CD or a DVD. It's a download. And to get it free, $250 worth of purchases or more gets you that for free. So quite a few people are doing that, taking advantage of that. And bonus interviews where I'm a guest, a bonus interview with Chuck Schrammick around 1997. And, of course, Chuck was central to that whole big controversy of Hale-Bopp back in the 90s. He was a talk show host from Houston, a friend of mine, died very suddenly, rapid onset cancer, just the same thing that happened to Robert Harrington, the head of the Naval Observatory. Anyway, all of that information in that release. So go to my webpage for more information on that, jmccsci.com. Update on the Wing Generator Project. And by the way, this week's show, I'll just be catching up on many science topics that have been in the news, but I've been avoiding them, unfortunately, because of the amazing amount of time I put into this Hale-Bopp Planet X special release of last week. And that's, a lot of people don't realize the amount of work that goes into one of these productions. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, one of the biggest jobs I have is knowing where to draw the line, because I had probably 7 hours of lecture notes, and I had to decide what to put in, you know, to get it down to a nominal level of only 3 extra hours, because people only have so much time. So to catch the important things, there's so much more on that topic. But anyway, the wing generator project, the fundraiser ends next Monday night. So if you have not donated yet, please go to the webpage. And, you know, I'm not going to pull teeth. If you're not going to donate, that's fine. It's going to benefit you and all your family and all your grandchildren someday. But be that as it may, the crowdfunding ends Monday evening at midnight. And the crowdfunding, just to explain again, is for the 12-meter model. And I have if you've been to the crowdfunding page, go back there. I have much nicer drawings, etc., better information on exactly what the wing generator looks like. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and click on the crowdfunding page. Also, I have a picture at the top of my homepage, and also I've got some videos coming online. They should be there already, talking about all of the myriad of topics. There's so many topics around this. We have electric cars, trucks, motorcycles, trains, airplanes, electric airplanes now, commercial electric airplanes that are flying. And these are going to become a reality. You know, they are a reality. They're just going to become bigger. Airbus already has a large 100-passenger airplanes, electric airplanes, on the drawing board. And these things are going to be here. I think I mentioned this before on a show. I went out and I bought one of these kids' airplanes, remote controlled, and it's made out of styrofoam, and it's got a DC motor in the front, and then this little battery pack, and it's like, I think, 3 little AAA size batteries. And that's the battery pack. And I thought, well, this is going to fly for about 2 minutes if it's lucky, and then come crashing down. That thing flew around for 20-25 minutes. I'm going, what are these, nuclear batteries or something? But the thing is that all the batteries and the motor technology have come so far. They're so efficient, and it's going to improve easily in the next 5 years. So electric motorcycles with 200-mile range, which is equivalent to a gas recharge. Utility vehicles, these four-wheel vehicles that, you know, people use out on the farm or the ranch, and hunters and sportsmen use them. Electric. That's the new thing. Non-polluting, make no noise, and charge. They run. The battery packs last just as long as a tank of gas. I mean, this is the wave of the future, and these things have power. If, and this should have been here a long time ago. Remember the Peugeot, actually, in the early 1900s had an electric car with the wheel motors and everything. But the whole problem with all of this is that we do not have a good, clean source of energy. If you have an electric or a hybrid car and you think, doggone, I'm so green and really conscientious and everything, hey, step back and think for a minute, because you're getting your electrical energy from coal or nuclear power. And it's about a 10%, if you're lucky, efficiency. So you're burning about 9 times or 10 times the amount of fuel that it would actually take if you just burn gasoline in a car. So the problem is we don't have a current source of clean energy. I got a kick out of this. Now, the government is pushing solar panels big time. Hillary Clinton, and this just I can't stand these New World Order people. Hillary says she's going to pledge a half a billion solar panels be installed in the next 4 years if she gets elected. Oh, God help us all. But, you know, half a billion solar panels, it's not like she's giving them to anybody. She's going to try and pass legislation so that the government subsidies or whatever. But remember that none of these industries would be there if it weren't for government subsidies. And the bottom line is that already it's happening. In Canada, the Minister of Energy has passed an edict where the wind generators and other types of alternative energy, solar, primarily wind and solar, the manager at a central power station can tell the wind generator facility, don't produce power. And they also will pay them when they're not producing power. And so look at the people have paid up there. The Canadians are furious. They're ready to go out and hang people. I know I've talked to some of these Canadians and they're really mad. Their property values have gone down. They were sold this bill of goods. Everything is green. And no, these three-blade wind generators are sitting there idle. They don't do a thing. In fact, like I said, the government has a regulation that the operator of the central power company just sends out the signal, in fact, that they should not produce energy. And they pay them. Most of those towers in Canada get $500,000 a year in subsidies, and they don't produce a nickel's worth of electricity. So this is a giant scam, and the whole issue is they want to soak up everybody's investment in products that don't work. Solar panels don't work. Sorry, Elon Musk, you're betting on the wrong horse. But, you know, doggone, he's going to make lots of money. Already is. And the solar panels, they're already saying that they cannot use them. And this is going to happen as I said, the bigger the install base of what they call alternative energy. That's why I don't use any of these terms when I talk about my wing generation. I don't use the word wind. I talk about replacement energy, not alternative energy, because alternative energy is a boondoggle. It's meant to be a farce because they want to keep control in the hands of the central power company. Simple as that. And the governments are behind it. There's a law in Canada now that if you have any kind of alternative energy on your property, it has to hook into the grid. Now, imagine, they don't want some guy out in the middle of nowhere going off the grid, because once one guy does it, then the rest of them in all these little towns could go off the grid, and all of a sudden, gee, they're just not going to have control of those places, because if you control the energy, you control the people, just like water. You know, the thing is, in Canada, I've spent a bit of time in Canada, they talk about the Queensland. They talk about the Queensland. It all belongs to the Queen. In fact, the people are subjects. They belong to the Queen of England. Isn't that swell? Oh, man. Anyway, the Canadians are hopping mad over this three-blade wind generator scam. And unfortunately, it's given everything a royal bad name. So when something real comes along, like my wing generator, you know, that there's already so much resistance to this. In the whole history of the wing generator, going back, it's very difficult to explain. But when you start doing venture capital like that, that's why I'm doing crowdfunding now. When you're doing venture capital, which I experimented with, it doesn't work. Why? Because those people have investments in these other high energy content energy sources, coal, nuclear, natural gas, petroleum, etc., and then transportation, etc. And they don't want to see that investment go south. So anyway, yeah, the Hillary pledging $500 million solar panels, totally world new order, new world order, also pushing this based on climate change control. Oh, my goodness. You just know that that's a bowling ball coming down the alley when they bring up that term. Right now, the Pope on a world tour, and the Vatican has now an official policy to fight global climate change. Whatever that means, the Pope's doing it. Boy, I bet you, it just doesn't get any worse than that. Okay, so anyway, the next Monday night, just to make a long story short, the Wing Generator Project funding is coming to an end, but already on the way in the background is the development, and the whole goal here is to commercialize the 12-meter model. That's 39 feet in diameter, and you can get an idea of the size of this on the picture on my webpage, also on the crowdfunding page. And, you know, I'll tell you, 7,000 people went to that page and didn't contribute. And I there's a lot more people that went and did contribute. But if every one of those persons had contributed $20, holy buckets, just $10 each, that'd be way over the limit. I was looking for $50,000, and just to give you an idea, the power head alone on one of these units runs around $10,000. So this is not inexpensive stuff. But when you consider that over the lifetime of one of these products, people will not pay electricity anymore. And if you tried to compare this to the amount of energy, say, for solar panels, a set of solar panels would run $200,000 to $250,000. Plus, you'd have to buy a big battery pack because the sun only shines a few hours of the day. The Wing Generator is the real solution to the world energy problem. It can scale up to very large sizes. The 1,000-foot model, 304-meter diameter, is, I imagine, from my own calculations, three of them would be sufficient to power San Francisco. Add another three, and you could convert all of the automobiles to electric or compressed air. And I've got some pictures. Just a little note on compressed air. In 1875 in Paris, the Makarsky tram was running on compressed air. Just to give you an idea, boys and girls, that's 150 years ago, and it ran till 1928 when they finally converted to electric. These were trams that ran for that's like 55, 60 years. Those machines ran in Paris, carrying people around. And these were two-deckers, you know, filled with people running on compressed air. And Makarsky was a guy who figured out how to, when the compressed air comes out, it gets very cold. Actually, a good way to refrigerate. In fact, that's one of the prime uses for the Wing Generator, is to compress air and use it for refrigeration. A three-stage decompression and cooling. The first stage would be used for the freezer. The next two stages would be used for the refrigerator. Very, very efficient. But Makarsky figured out a way. What he did is he had a second tank where they heated up the outflowing gas, and it made it much, much more efficient. So, but like I said, on my webpage, I have a PowerPoint slideshow, which everybody should go see. It's right on near the top of the webpage. It's 25 slides. It takes you about 5 minutes to go through those. Everybody should go see this, but I have a picture of a train that ran from, the 1920s, I believe, up until 1968 in a mine in South Dakota. This was a big locomotive that had to carry the mine, all of the mine stuff, the rock, etc., out of the mine. And, of course, you can't have diesel or other any kind of spark, so you need some kind of energy that's reliable, has a lot of power, and doesn't give off any pollution of any, because you got your miners in there, something that's very, it doesn't vibrate, for example. So here this locomotive running for the better part of 60 years in was only decommissioned a short while ago, still running in the mines there. So look at the age of some of these vehicles. You know, 50, 60-year-old vehicle that's still operating on compressed air. And so I'm very excited about this entire issue because the wing generator can compress air directly without conversion to electricity. And it will, with some advances, it's not quite there with batteries yet, but people don't count the ecological disaster side of batteries. Lithium-ion batteries, sure, they're great, but there's a cost. There's a cost to everything. It turns out that Afghanistan was one of the richest areas for lithium, that they're making the lithium-ion batteries out of. But the what's the cost of a war to go over there and sustain a war for how many years so that you can get lithium? And of course, you can't forget the CIA cocaine, or not cocaine, but over there it's the poppy heroin trafficking that goes into Europe, and I'm sure it comes to the United States. All of the drug addicts and the social disease that comes off of all of that. But also Afghanistan was a big source of lithium. So at any rate, but yeah, there's a cost to all of this. And I've mentioned before, if you take the real cost of pouring gasoline into your car, the real cost is extraordinary if you take the cost of wars and, not to mention the social damage done to those countries. There are areas of Iraq where people are not allowed to have babies because all the babies are deformed from the uranium, depleted uranium shells, the covers of the big cannon shells and the tank shells were depleted uranium. Yeah, the people can't have kids there. They're destroyed. Their entire generation is going to die off, and that's the end of those people forever because of the pollution there. So these things have a cost, and we never talk about that. You talk about the price of, so many dollars per gallon of gas. No, sorry, buddy, that ain't the real cost. Or when somebody charges their electric car with coal or nuclear, oh, no. You're talking, and this is going to hit. We have 100 nuclear power plants in the United States that are over their commission, their license time. And all of these, certainly within the next 5 to 10 years, are going to be decommissioned. They have to be, or otherwise they're already leaking a lot of them. And it's about $2 to $5 billion to decommission a single nuclear power plant. What a mess! And that doesn't take into account what do you do with all the spent fuel rods that are floating around there. You know, that's an absolute disaster. Germany and Japan have completely shut down their entire nuclear reactor fleets. Japan, for good reason. Germany saw it coming. They don't want anything to do with it and are desperate for real alternative energy. So the wing generator is coming online. It should be available commercially, I would hope, this fall. But the part of the crowdfunding was to help with the getting the commercialization of the wing generator. Okay, well, enough of that. But I'm very excited about this. This is one of my babies, and it's going to lead to many, many other things. I have many other, let's say, items up my sleeve that are not necessarily in the energy industry, but the wing generator is already has a lot of interest. There are locations around the world that are already standing in line once these things come off the assembly line. So that's the whole point of the crowdfunding right now, to commercialize the 12-meter model and get that out there. I did a lot of work, a lot of background work, and the 12-meter model is the one that's going to sell the most over the long term. That's the one that's going to have the highest numbers. And there's other reasons for picking 12 meters. If you're in the the rest of the world, not including the United States and Canada, even Canada is on the metric system. You cross the border and you're driving in kilometers. The United States and I think one African country are the only countries in the world that still use the English system of measurement. But the point is, the 12-meter model is designated for a lot of the rest of the world. And so everything is metric. So I wasn't going to build something in English units that's going to go in the rest of the world. And let's face it, the United States is really, really bottoming out. In all respects. Okay, well, anyway, enough of that. The Pluto, New Horizons, I didn't get to talk about that last week. The data finally came in, NASA absolutely confirming that I was correct. Remember, weeks and weeks ago, in fact, before that was before the May 29th photos that came out showing Pluto to have active comet tail activity, all of the new photos have been so photoshopped. I just knew it. That, you know, they're just basically useless. NASA certainly has a lot of better photographs than what they're putting out there, but that's the simple Simon Silly science they can get away. But they had to admit that Pluto is acting like a comet. They say that the tail material is coming off the off the planetary surface. Well, boys and girls, sorry, it's going the other way. So they've made this the classic backwards interpretation of data once again. You know, the whole idea that comets are losing matter. They also finally admitted that Venus and Mars have comet tails. And now, typically in the past, when you talked about planetary tails, you talked about magnetic tails like Earth or Jupiter or Saturn, and they called them geomagnetic tails. Well, that was a big misnomer, because they're all the same. Now you have Venus and Mars, which do not have magnetic fields. They have little teeny, teeny magnetic fields, but not enough to cause a magnetic, geomagnetic tail like Earth. And like I say, the term geomagnetic tail is a misnomer, because what it's really doing, the Earth, Jupiter, the other planets that do have tails, those are the discharge of the solar capacitor. Venus, Mars, also discharging the solar capacitor. And so finally, and it's very bizarre the way NASA does this, Pluto has a tail, and so they go, oh yeah, well, Venus and Mars do too. Just like, oh yeah, we knew it all the time, we're so good. You know, that's one of my main predictions, that all of the planets would have tails, and that's due to the discharge of the solar capacitor, and they are attracting this material. Now, Mars, it is known, has just probably quadrupled its atmosphere in the last 20 years. So it's adapting water and all of the various atmospheric compounds, CO2, nitrogen, hydrogen, etc., is adapting these into its atmosphere and building up. Water, primary constituent. When comet sightings spring past Mars, it added a lot to the Martian atmosphere, and including metals. So very clearly, comets are attracting this material, and the planets are too. But what else can you say? That the other thing they admitted was that the surface of Pluto and the surface of Charon, its first and major moon, which is about half the size of Pluto, that these are very, very young surfaces. And they see the activity going on there. But, of course, Pluto is extremely distant from the sun. So there's no reason, even if you're dealing with nitrogen, there's no reason to imagine that these are why there would be any heat there. That's the issue. Why should there be any heat at Pluto? You can see washes. You can see water ice that's moving. So Pluto is a relatively warm planet. So is Charon. That, and the reason you know this is because if there's an impact crater, and they actually did see an impact crater that was filling in with liquid. And so how come Pluto is warm? How come the Pacific Ocean is warm? Why is El Nino there? These are plasma heating effects. You call it Joule heating. Whenever you have a current and it stops at an object, that energy, that goes someplace. In fact, that's why, say, a wire heats up. Literally the collisions of the electrons with the atoms in the wire literally is what is heating that wire up. And that's what we call resistance. The inability of electrical current, primarily electrons, to pass through without being slowed down and stopped. So they stop, they get picked up by the electric field, and they move a little bit. And I forget one of the calculations we did in physics as probably freshmen was, what is the velocity of an electron in a current? And we always think, oh, things move at the speed of light, or you were familiar with the electric fields move at the speed of light, minus the internal characteristics of the wire. But pretty much in a piece of wire, electric fields and magnetic fields move at the speed of light. So one might expect that electrons, which are the charge carriers, primary charge carriers in an electric current in a wire, you would expect them to move very fast, but they don't. They move extremely slowly. In fact, that's, you know, it's because they're bumping into something, an atom, etc. They bump into it, cause heating, and then they slide off, so to speak, and then pick up, move in the electric field again. But they're moving an extremely small distance over a long period of time. The electron velocity is very low. So anyway, the point is that in the Pacific Ocean, I was just talking, I was on a radio show this past week talking about Joule heating, what we call El Nino. And that's really a misnomer. El Nino is a term developed by the fishermen in Latin America, on the Pacific coast, when they detected a rainier than average season. And since it typically happened around Christmas time, they called it El Nino after the Christ child. But modern science has picked up that term and talks in terms of El Nino being the heating of the Pacific Ocean, and they claim that that is what causes the rain, etc. But it's really not true. There are other factors. The reality is that this, for example, this past year, this past winter, there was the rainiest El Nino in the traditional sense, the rainiest El Nino year on record, but there was no, literally no heating of the Pacific Ocean. So once again, standard science totally wrong, and but just a little bit faint to admit it there. But going back to Pluto and the planets, and by the way, the heating of the Pacific Ocean, the El Nino, is a direct result of electron current coming in from outside the planet, and it drops down into the Pacific. They know that the El Nino heating is not from below. It's from above, and they can't figure out what's causing it. Well, my work shows exactly what it is. Also with Pluto. Pluto is in the discharge of the solar capacitor, so that's where it gets its heat from. And so it's a very young planet. It's building up primarily nitrogen atmosphere, and it's a warm planet, relatively warm, even though some people might not call frozen nitrogen warm, but compared to what it should be out there, our sun looks like a weak flashlight on a London foggy night where Pluto is. It's just not there. It looks like a big star, kind of, where Pluto is. And so really there's no sunlight there to heat up Pluto. So how does Pluto maintain its heat? It's the discharge of the local capacitor. And if you look at pictures we have of other stars, you can see the nebular ion cloud around the other star and all of the planet-making activity that's going on in the form of comets. Okay, I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. Talk about the weather, the tremendous flooding activity. Florida seeing tremendous flooding this past week. You know, it's really amazing. You get in these flat places like Florida. When it rains, there's no place for the water to go. It just sits there. So you have feet and feet of water. I saw one set of videos from St. Augustine, Florida, and cars up to the bumper driving through water. So a tremendous amount of water in certain parts of the United States, and record heat up in the northeast sector of the country. Very interesting, strange weather. It's hard to say how much is manipulated. You have chemtrail spraying going on. You have manipulation. You have HAARP coming back online this week. Laser satellites that are there manipulating. There's so many people manipulating weather today. You have Monsanto out there. You have so many people manipulating weather. I don't think they even know who else is doing it. It's like... This is the craziest thing. I mean, this world is so crazy. If it weren't real, I'd think it was just a bad dream. But unfortunately, it's real. Here's something sent in by a listener, that there's a coming crisis within the next decade in jet fuel. They say that as the Asian Chinese middle class is created and grows, there will be an increased demand for air travel for business. And that'll put the airlines love it. That'll be many more jet plane sales for them, you know, and fuel usage, etc. So that's all good for people who are in those businesses. But the issue is jet fuel. Is there going to be enough jet fuel? So anyway, a listener sent in this. And that says why airlines keep pushing for biofuels. This is from a trade magazine. And they say that the airlines are turning to a technology very few have been able to make work on a large scale. And this is converting trash into fuel. I'm not sure if that's really going to work enough to provide the jet traffic. At any given time, just in the United States, we have over 7,000 aircraft in the air at one time. They're saying that that right now there's about 3.6 billion air traffic passengers per year. So somebody's carrying their weight out there as far as flying a lot. But imagine that. The number of passengers, 3.5 billion in a year. And so in the next couple decades, they're looking for new ways to get biofuel in various countries. They talk about, and they say that cars and trains, etc., can run on electricity, natural gas, and even hydrogen, but lifting a few hundred people, suitcases and cargo, some 35,000 feet into the sky and carrying them across a continent requires so much energy that only liquid fuels can do it. And so they go on talking about the U.S. airlines burn through 45 million gallons every day. Let me read that again. The U.S. Airlines go through 45 million gallons a day of jet fuel. Well, that's just insane. And now here's a topic this gives me a platform to talk about, a very important topic. And here it is, that the airplanes are plowing through the atmosphere at 35,000 feet. And like many assumptions in modern society, we all think that that's the way it has to be. But they never talk about what we call cryogenic. In other words, by carrying a bit of oxygen in a tank and converting those engines instead of burning pure air, because once you get up above 35,000 feet, the air gets rather thin. And so that's pretty much where all the jets are tuned to fly. But you could use a absolute fraction of the liquid fuel if you went suborbital. In other words, you went into a parabolic orbit, and actually it would be more of an elliptical orbit, but within the upper atmosphere, and make that one last race into low orbit. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the airframes, the aircraft airframes, everything from the Boeing 727, I wonder if there's still Boeing 727s flying around. They had the two engines in the rears. I used to love those planes. They were just like almost like a high-performance aircraft. All of the airframes fully have the capability of going into low Earth orbit, because they withstand that pressure differential between air and vacuum. When they're flying through the air, the above the cockpit, right behind the cockpit, is a very good vacuum, because the air comes up and it cannot get down in time against the skin of the aircraft. So there's actually a pretty good vacuum up there, and these things fly all over the place. The reality is that the airframes that we currently have for regular airlines are fully capable of going into low Earth orbit. So then all you do is you give it an extra boost with oxygen, send this jet into low Earth orbit, basically, and you don't really leave the atmosphere. But the point is, you glide then and you avoid burning all of this fuel. But, like many things and systems are favored because they're extremely fuel costly. And so all of this idea of ecological and no. It's just like Detroit and the oil companies, the airline industry is very much coupled with the energy industry. And they want to continue to burn that high heat content petrol fuel in aircraft. But it also brings back the topic that electric airplanes, this year, just a few weeks ago at the Paris Air Show, Airbus, the E-plane, finally flew commercially. It did a flyover of the Paris Air Show, but just an electric airplane, like a big model, like a kid's model, but big enough for two people to fly around. Top speed, 80 kilometers per hour, flies for about an hour, so it can go 80 kilometers. And the batteries are in the wings. So anyway, this technology is going to improve. And a lot of people think, well, gee, I really wouldn't want to be flying in something that's depending on a battery. But it's probably safer than jet fuel in terms of just the plane safety factor. At any rate, this crisis of jet fuel, they say, is on its way, and we'll see exactly where that goes in the future. But worth mentioning, as we move into the future, as we move into a new era of energy, I should mention that I'm working on an expose on future transportation. And so that'll be something to keep an eye out for. That's one of my projects somewhat in the background. But it's very interesting to see the future of transportation. It's going to look very different. And much of this was actually developed hundred years ago or more. But the difference is we have technologies today that they did not have then. And so we're taking things that are sometimes old ideas and refining them, putting some new technology, some new ideas with it, and coming up with some really amazing solutions. So keep your eyes out for that. In doing my research for the Wing Project and trying to understand all of the various aspects of the energy industry, this is really, really strange, in fact, weird. I went on the internet the other day because I was putting together this PowerPoint slide presentation, and I was missing one thing. I needed a picture of a coal-fired power plant. And I thought, okay, well, I'll just quick Google that, and I'll come up with, you know, lists of, I'll be able to pick one that's, you know, a good picture of a power plant. There is not a single picture of a power plant, a coal-fired power plant, on the internet. And you go to, you know, the, where would you go first? You go to Google, you know, and type in pictures. None. It has been cleansed of pictures of coal-fired power plants. Wow, I'm thinking this is strange. And there's, if you go to Wikipedia, there's nothing there. There's not even a simple little write-up on coal power plants. They have a couple mentions. They talk about Duke Energy and a couple of the bigger power plants down in the southeastern United States, but no pictures, no information, nothing. And I thought, now that just seems more than strange in a world where, you know, such an essential part of our entire existence, coal power plants, then there's not a shred of information on that. So if anybody can find any out there, let me know. But I just thought that was one of the strangest things. I just got there and there's nothing. There's no references. There's no, you do a Google search and they have some things that come up, but when you click on them, there's no pictures. There's really no information. Anyway, that just was very strange. Just a quick comment here. This was on spaceweather.com. They were talking about an airliner that went up to, I think, 39,000 feet. And they said the amount of radiation, they're talking about X-rays, was inordinate. It was a huge amount of radiation. Now, they talk in terms of cosmic rays. Cosmic rays are high-energy protons. But what happens is when they hit things, they turn into X-rays. And so what, apparently this was a group of students, and they had gone on an Airbus 319, it was, a flight, FL640 was the flight number. And they said within minutes of takeoff, the radiation in the cabin tripled, and it went up to many, many, many times the surface level radiation, which means we are very much protected down here at the surface of the Earth. And our atmosphere provides a tremendous amount of protection against radiation. And so the reason we can walk around without iron hats on is because of our atmosphere. Just a quick mention also that I forget, one of the search teams discovered a planet very Earth-like. They said the first really Earth-like planet covered with water. And I wanted to let you know something. Back in the Noah's flood day, the ocean levels rose between 200 and 600 feet. Well, the surface area of the Earth diminished greatly. If we were to have another 200 to 600 foot ocean rise due to a flood, and this is not due to global warming or anything, this would be due to the passage of a large comet where we went through the comet tail. And like I said in my notes regarding last week, and also in the my 2-CD set, The Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters, that if we had passed through the tail of Comet Hale-Bopp, it would have taken us about 40 days and 40 nights, and we would have had torrential rain during that entire time, increasing the level of the oceans probably a couple hundred feet. Well, let's do this about 3 or 4 or 5 times. We're talking another 1,000 feet, and there are maps, and I think there's programs online you can see these, where you can increase the ocean level by, you know, half a foot, 2 feet, 5 feet, 10 feet, 100 feet, etc., and see how much land remains. And it's really not much. There's a lot of land would go under the ocean. And that kind of brought up a very interesting point, that if we're talking about, remember, Atlantis went under the ocean, and we always, and I've always thought this way, we always think that Atlantis, there was an earthquake and it just sank under the ocean. But what about the ocean level rising was the cause of Atlantis disappearing? Because after the disaster, the Ancient Mariners went back And they couldn't find Atlantis. They just found the floating bogs, etc. And, of course, like I've said in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, the main island of Atlantis. Now, Atlantis was a worldwide power, so it had colonies all over the place. In fact, in Greece and Egypt were colonies of Atlantis. But the main mother island where the ringed city, etc., was in the South China Sea. And that is very much confirmed. But at any rate, what if instead of sinking under the ocean levels rose, and that was attributable to Noah's flood? Because that's just one of the possibilities. I'm not saying that that's what happened. I'm just saying that is a definite possibility for a whole continent to just sink. It almost seems like too unlikely a scenario. But for an entire continent that was very flat. In fact, they said Atlantis, the continent of Atlantis was very flat. And that would, once again, fit very nicely with the South China Sea. And about the area also. There was a physicist, and I'll repeat this, give credit where credit is due, from, I think it was from Brazil. But he put together he took the whole world as a grid, and he took a grid work of all the known factors of Atlantis and made a checkoff, kind of an area checkoff. And he said that none of the areas of the world made any sense to be Atlantis. And one of the big factors was it was a big flat area. And the only place that really remained was the South China Sea. That was the only place that fit all of the various known requirements. And so by doing that, he discovered that that's where it was. As I said in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, I backed into, by mistake, a Navy secure website, and it was located in the North Shore of Australia, and they were actively excavating the South China Sea where Atlantis was. So at any rate, and you can imagine that the world powers were the ones very much involved in that. So that's another indication that Tier 1 science is very much controlled by the bankers. And they hold that much higher in importance than oil or money, because they have all the money in the world. That's no problem. But to understand the history that was lost during the last great disasters is very important to them. That's why when they went into the Iraq War, the first Iraq War, they went for two things. They went to the oil fields. They surrounded them with the tanks, etc., secured the oil fields. And the other thing they did is they went into the museums and digs, archaeological digs of Saddam Hussein's archaeologists. And there's a story of a guy who was the curator of one of the museums in Iraq, one of the oldest museums in the world, sitting there with his head between his hands, and he knew it was the CIA went in there and got all of the best artifacts. They knew exactly what they were after. It included ancient batteries, all kinds of other artifacts that were related to the ancient world. Well, how did I get off on this topic? I was talking about cosmic rays and airplanes. Well, anyway, back to 39,000 feet with these students. And just a quick note, and this is what I want to comment on. It says there was no solar storm in progress. This is reading from the spaceweather.com webpage. It says the extra radiation was just the regular drizzle of cosmic rays reaching down to aviation altitudes. This radiation is ever-present and comes from the supernovas, black holes, and other sources across the galaxy. Well, boys and girls, let me tell you something. Cosmic rays come from our own atmosphere. This is well understood. They come from thunderstorms. They're known to occur above thunderstorms. They come from other sources in the near-Earth environment, and primarily from the electron beam coming from the discharge of the solar capacitor. And so anyway, I just want to make that comment because unfortunately these kids were accompanied by a guy named Tony Phillips, who was, he's the guy who does a lot of this is science at NASA kind of thing, giving totally incorrect explanations to the public. I want to spend the last couple minutes of the show going back to the topic of the wing generator. This is something, I'll be honest with you, is one of my favorite things I've done in my career. I mean, I've got so many different things: the induced electric dipole redshift, the plasma discharge comet model, the surface fusion of the sun, the reason for the relativistic electrons around the sun, what we call the corona, the source of the solar wind energy, how that develops in the atmosphere of the sun and comes shooting out towards the corona, which is a sea of electrons, and opens up the coronal holes and comes blasting through, why the solar wind continues out all the way beyond the orbit of Pluto, unabated, like a Van de Graaff generator, the development of galaxies. There's so many topics that I've developed in my career, and not to mention the calculate primes information or breaking RSA codes for fun and profit. But the wing generator is something I'm very proud of, because if you look at the history of use of wind, it goes back to China, I mean the Netherlands, you have all kinds of devices that have used the wind, but this is a breakthrough that will literally change the energy structure of the world. And this will go into third world countries. It's already scheduled. And so, once again, I'm just very, very pleased with this. There's so many subtle aspects to this design. The way the wings work, the fact that it's scalable. People will not appreciate this, and I'll say this twice. People will not appreciate the wing generator till they start to see the big ones. Then they're going to go, wow. In fact, in my PowerPoint presentation, I have an example where I've put three of them up alongside the Golden Gate Bridge. When you start seeing the big ones and the advantage of the big ones, and it's very subtle physics in aerodynamics and a lot of thermodynamics, a lot of physics that go into understanding this, people are going to be amazed, because literally these are going to be replacing, like the Hoover Dam. Two of these could replace the Hoover Dam, the big ones, the 1,000-foot models. But right now we're dealing with the 12-meter model commercialization. This is what's going to make it all happen. Go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. And make a little contribution, make some contribution, and be part of this. And if you, like I say, go back to the crowdfunding page. I've got a video up now. It gives a much better rendition of the wing generator and how it works, etc., what it looks like. So thank you very much. And see you next week on this show. I'll be continuing the topics about science, the outer space, space science, astronomy, etc. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.